they did. You don't know what they sacrificed. We have lost touch with the principles in the Constitution. Nobody's read the Declaration of Independence. You are voting for socialism, and you got what you voted for.
Welcome, bold Americans, to another episode of America Emboldened. As always, I'm your host, Greg Bolden, both here on the America Out Loud Network, as well as all the social media platforms live on Thursday nights on Rumble, Twitch, YouTube, X, you name it. We are there right now taking your questions. I see a ton of people signing in right now, as well as on the America Out Loud Network. Make sure you go to americaoutloud.news, where you can check out all of my colleagues' work, people like the great Dr. Peter McCullough, who will be with me next week discussing some very important medical health information, as well as you can check out my co-host, Chris Michael's show, Unleashed, the Political Hour, airing every single Monday at 7 p.m. on the 24/7 Talk Radio Network of America Out Loud. You can download that on all of your favorite app stores and your favorite devices, or stream it directly through the website. Chris Michaels, how you doing this great end of the week?
Pretty good. You ready for everything that's going to happen?
I am. I'm excited for everything that's right. You know, Gentry Jevers just put a little comment. Heck yeah, he's ready for this conversation. We're gonna have a good time. That's right. So let's
gird your loins. Let's go.
It's going to be great. So if you don't know the theme of the week so far, I've been talking about the Marxism that's coming into this country and how I'm worried about whether or not there's a youth movement to keep conservative values and conservative candidates going forward. And our guest tonight actually co-authored a book that just came out about a month and a half ago called The Emerging Populist Majority. His name is Gavin Mario Wax. This guy's impressive, Michaels. I mean, 76th president of the New York Young Republican Club. But what actually caught my eye is he's the executive director of the National Constitutional Law Union. And Michaels, you know how much I love people that are passionate about the Constitution. So
I certainly do. You can't get enough of it.
No, I'm excited. So let's, without further ado, get Gavin Wax straight up to the stage. Gavin, how you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. It's great to be with you guys, Greg and Chris. I'm looking forward to the discussion. Thank you for the great introduction.
Absolutely. I'm glad to give you a great introduction. You deserve it. Well, let's get straight to the conversation at heart right now. We have a State of the Union address coming up here in about an hour and 20 minutes, or if you're listening on Friday on the network, it's already happened. About 6 years ago, liberals and MSNBC, they lost their collective minds and said that Donald Trump was using the State of the Union address as a campaign stump speech. What makes Joe Biden any different forcing this State of the Union all the way into the first week of March? I mean, normally these things are at the end of January, sometime in February. This has got to be lined up to align with Super Tuesday. This is the same exact thing, you know, different team, different rules. Gavin, tell me. What is happening with the way the Democrats are playing games, and do Republicans have an answer for what the Democrats have been doing for the last 4 years?
Well, it's a good question. It's a big question to start off with. In general, I think most mainstream Republicans, most run-of-the-mill Republicans, are always on the back foot politically from the Democrats. They don't play to win. They don't play as aggressively. They're not as power-hungry. They're not as Machiavellian. And they're not as ruthless. And maybe you can claim it's because they have higher morals, but we know many of Republican establishment leaders don't have morals either. They're just dumb and are also corrupt. I think really what this comes down to is you have two different factions. One is bringing a knife to a gunfight, and one's bringing a gun to a gunfight, and you can understand who would be winning that fight. That is until President Trump, in my opinion, emerged on the stage, taught Republicans how to fight back effectively, go on the offensive, be aggressive, go after the media, go after the institutions, go after the Democrat Party machine, and actually secure wins. So we're seeing that sort of trend change with this new sort of populism that's emerging as embodied in President Trump. But listen, I think the last 4 years, you know, or a little less actually, but the last the few years so far of this current administration, this current regime, as I'd like to call it, have been disastrous for the country. But if you're a Democrat, and many things are actually going quite well. The country is being flooded. You're importing tons of new voters. You're brainwashing many more through the various institutions under their control, whether it's in academia, whether it's the media, or even corporate America. So on paper, what looks like a pretty clear and evident decline in the United States to a left-wing strategist who's looking at it in a sober, cool, calm, and collected way, they would say they've been scoring nothing but victories. But tonight's State of the Union, I think, is going to be a little bit surreal. I think you're going to see an emperor who has no clothes. I think that's how the world is going to see it. You're most likely going to see a aged and delirious gentleman being propped up on a cocktail of drugs, kind of like the collective West in person form, struggling to get through his speech, struggling to make basic points in a coherent fashion. And maybe we'll have some gaffes, maybe we'll have some funny moments, probably more sad in the grand scheme of things, but nothing that we haven't come to expect in this giant humiliation ritual that is known as the Biden regime.
Wow, that was a lot to process there, Michaels.
Intro, right?
Yeah, I love it, Kevin. You know, I tossed you a large topic right off the get-go, and you didn't disappoint going into all that. I want to start off with your work that you've been doing with the book that just released. And people can find the book on Amazon, The Emerging Populist Majority, written by Troy Olson as well as Gavin Wax. Let me put that link up on the screen for everybody that wants to check out the book. You know, if you were to tell me a few years ago that the conservative movement would be writing a book about the emerging populist majority, I would have kind of laughed and said, no, that would be like a Bernie Sanders type of topic. You know, you go back over 8 years ago when Bernie Sanders and the one percenters were talking about how no one was representing the common person. And now it seems that there's a hijack from progressives into Marxism to have this representation that no one asked for. And it's really the elite. I mean, the pandemic kind of pointed out people like Fauci, people like Bill Gates, people that were in the billionaire class dictating what the future was going to be, the WEF coming out saying, you know, you'll own nothing and you're going to be happy. Now I'm looking at your book and I'm thinking, what a shift that now the conservative movement is really the movement for the people, for the common person that feels completely unrepresented and not part of the machine in Washington, D.C. How is the conservative movement at this point in time moving towards reestablishing constitutional principles as well as correcting or overcorrecting in some respects the media and the culture that has developed in a vacuum over the last 4 years?
Well, listen, it's another big grand question. I mean, I'll say this, that the Constitution is dead or dying. It's hanging on by a thread, whichever way you want to look at it. And that's the fault of both parties. That's not a partisan issue. That's a bipartisan issue. The Constitution has been chipped away at for many decades, for many cycles, for many generations, really, from a variety of different angles and for a variety of different reasons. That we could do a whole show on that. But to your broader points that you were bringing up about populism and the political dichotomy, I mean, yes, absolutely. Populism has historically been viewed as more of a left-wing term, a left-wing movement. I think populism in general takes many different shapes, many different forms, depending on the country, depending on the point in time. It's usually described as being against something. Populism is against the current elites, the current elitism, the current state of affairs, the status quo. Conservatism, in sort of a more base sense, is protecting the status quo. So in some cases, you could even describe, you know, the Biden regime as being conservative, that they're trying to protect the status quo. I don't want to get into a whole semantics argument, but the reality is, I think populism as a political term has entered into the American political lexicon. It's become used primarily to describe figures on the right. And I think it's a solid term. It's a term that relates to a lot of people. And I think it's a term that defines a lot of the crises that we're facing in this current time, in this current age in American political history. We're having a situation of the haves and the have-nots. We're having a situation with an out-of-touch political elite that is, you know, high on their own supply of cultural Marxism, nihilism, globalism, this cocktail of different isms and political ideologies that are completely anathema to the constitutionalism you talk about, to the conservatism and the traditionalism that really built this country, and to the basic economic principles that have kept us prosperous for so long. So, you know, the average American, the average Joe Schmo, they're under attack. They're under attack economically. They're under attack politically, and in some ways, and most importantly, they're under attack culturally. And the pushback to this, the pushback from the, you know, the forgotten men and women, the so-called silent majority, however you want to spin it, has been the sort of populism that President Trump has become the standard bearer of, attacking the institutions, attacking DC, attacking the swamp, going on the offensive, you know, maybe changing a lot of things that were traditionally held near and dear to the conservative movement, a lot of things that would probably properly be described now as, you know, different, you know, versions of Reaganism or neoliberalism or even neoconservatism, especially as it pertains to foreign policy. So we've seen an America that's been gutted economically, spiritually, culturally. Our blood and treasure has been wasted overseas on forever wars that had no value to us as Americans. We've seen jobs, good paying jobs, be outsourced. We've seen our borders be flooded, not just with masses of migrants, but also drugs and other societal ills. So we've seen a general decline in the West and in the United States. And it's been a trend that we've seen happening under different administrations by a bipartisan uniparty consensus in DC in the Beltway. They've sold America, not even to the highest bidder, to the lowest bidder. And they've basically left us, you know, high and dry. And because of that, when you have times that are bad, economically, culturally, spiritually, or otherwise, it lends itself to political movements that rise to replace the status quo and the current order of things. And that current movement in the United States is best described as this new populist movement, largely on the right, but there's certainly some adherents that were winning over on the left or formerly leftists. But what happens and what's going to happen remains to be seen. Our book, The Emerging Populist Majority, follows a series of books that go back to the 1960s, 1969's The Emerging Republican Majority, describing Nixon's you know, election. Then we have the Emerging Democrat Majority of 2004, which inaccurately predicted the sort of woke professional class Obama coalition being ascendant. Never actually happened because of someone like President Trump. But we follow that tradition. We describe the trends. We describe the demographics. We describe, most importantly, the history and where the country's heading electorally as a result.
So I was going to say, like, do you think that anybody on the left is going to realize the error of their ways? I mean, I saw a stat today that said 10% of Biden voters are now going to vote for Trump. I mean, 10% of 81 million, that's a huge number, don't you think?
Well, that's what carried him the first time. What carried him was the crossover Obama-Trump voters, which I think were at least 10 million, 10 to 15. My memory is fading a bit, but it's a large number of people, and it's a large number of people that didn't necessarily feel represented by the Republican Party of old, the country club Republican politics of old, the Chamber of Commerce, the donor class, you know, these elites that are a little bit sheltered from a lot of the, lower, you know, a lot of consequences of their policies over the years. So I think the coalition that President Trump is building is cross partisan lines. It's brought over new voters. It's brought over different voters. We've certainly shed ground electorally in places like the suburbs and places like that have high, you know, numbers of college educated white voters, for example. I mean, you've seen the electoral map change, but those trends were happening even before President Trump came to power. I mean, you know, Colorado, for example, or Virginia, both of these states were trending away from the Republican Party long before Trump came on. He may have recognized these trends and expedited it and saw where we can have pickups elsewhere, say the Rust Belt, say the Blue Wall, say many culturally and socially conservative Union Democrats who certainly exist and have been discussed about in elections before as Reagan Democrats. So I think there are, to your question, I think there's certainly a lot of people that are feeling the economic pinch. They're feeling the cultural and social discourse shift rapidly to the left, way outside what they're comfortable with. And they've seen this happen in a short period of time. They've seen institutions that they once held in high regard be debased and used for politicized purposes. And they've seen all of this, and maybe they weren't card-carrying members of the Republican Party 10 years ago, but now they've been convinced, and they see a need for real change, not the fake hope and change that they were promised back in 2008.
I have some concerns about the Republican Party at this point in time, just because of my own state here in Delaware. The Republican Party is largely without vision. It's largely without good leadership. It was hijacked several years ago by groups that kind of took power away and then all the good old network of conservatives kind of were like, I don't know what to do with this. And they packed up and I've never seen them again here in the state. I'm concerned that right now, if you look at, you know, Nikki Haley was running and she represents that uni party. She represents kind of like a Democrat in sheep's clothing in a lot of ways. But I got to wonder, how does Trump get those votes that were going to Nikki Haley in spots where it wasn't Democrats voting as well? And where does he get the excitement against an RFK Jr. That's going to be siphoning votes, I think, from both Joe Biden as well as Donald Trump? This is a very close race, I think, in 2024. It shouldn't be. I think the choice is very clear. But I'm curious as to what's being done by the Republican Party. What's being done? I know you're an ambassador with Turning Point. What's things look like come November? What's the action plan?
Well, a few things I want to respond to there. One, you know, obviously I'm no fan of the Republican Party apparatus, the structure, the hierarchy, the formal organization. I think that's really where we've been lacking. I think that Republican Party, those leaders, that establishment have failed. They failed in their promises. They failed to, you know, get with the times. They failed to tap into a lot of this populist anger and this populist resentment for the status quo. And they've just failed to really protect the America that we all grew up in, the America that we were promised. So I have no love or affection or sympathy for a lot of these corrupt Republican grifters and party apparatchiks who have really sold their constituents time and time again. And that's represented by a large number of representatives in the House and senators in D.C. With that said, I think a few points to be made. I think in terms of the Nikki Haley voters you bring up, I think a good portion of them are going to come home. They're going to vote Republican. They're going to vote for Trump, even if they, you know, stuck their nose up at him during the primary. I think most of these voters will end up coming home. I think Biden is just that unpopular. I think they recognize that maybe they disagree with President Trump's rhetoric, maybe his gait, his force of personality, and some other superficial matters. I think many of them will admit, if you corner them and force them to admit the truth, they did like many elements of his actual policy successes and his platform, at least a good part of them that actually impacted them directly. So I'm not too worried about the Nikki Haley voters. Obviously, a lot of those numbers were inflated by Democrats, as you mentioned, in these open primaries. But I think most of these people, they're kind of wasted protest vote. I think ultimately they're going to come back home. On the RFK Jr. topic, I've been pretty consistent in believing that RFK is going to be a benefit to President Trump. I think he draws far more disaffected Dems, disaffected liberals, particularly in blue states, than he does disaffected Republicans in red states or disaffected independents leaning towards Republicans in red or purple states. I think he's going to do well in places like Massachusetts and places like Vermont and maybe New Hampshire and maybe in the Pacific Northwest, in areas that Republicans are not going to win statewide, certainly not with President Trump, and certainly not in a few cycles to come. So I think he's going to be far more of a nuisance to the Democrats and to Joe Biden than he is to President Trump. I think he still has he's still a bona fide liberal at the end of the day. He does have his own, you know, unique views on things like vaccines and occasionally when he shows the courage on foreign policy. But we've seen him already flip flop on that topic a few times. So I do think he's going to be a far more benefit to President Trump electorally. And I think the polls support my thesis where you see where he and other candidates are included. It only increases the margins for Trump, but it only really brings more states into play for President Trump. And historically, third party challengers like an RFK have historically always hurt the incumbent party and hurt the incumbent president, that being President Biden. So, you know, speaking of the corrupt and crooked and incompetent Republican party that I was just talking about, they would be wise to fight for ballot access for as many of these third party challengers as they can, Cornel West being one of them. I think that would be beneficial, much closer to a leftist by any standard definition than RFK Jr. He would certainly pull from Biden and his base, which is this very loosey-goosey base of, you know, disparate groups and disparate cohorts of people that are united primarily by their hatred of Trump, but their economic views, their cultural views, even their foreign policy views are beginning to clash. We're seeing that in places like Michigan with large Arab American populations revolting against, you know, supposedly the pro-Israel stances of Biden. So we're seeing gaps in their coalition and when and where we can get third-party challengers, either RFK or Cornel West, on the ballot. I think that's only to our benefit. And listen, the Democrats have done this game before. Democrats are ruthless, as I mentioned in the opening. They will deny ballot access for Green Party candidates, but they would ensure a Libertarian stays on the ballot because they understand that a Libertarian is going to draw from the right, a Green is going to draw from the left. Do one, not the other. You're going to benefit politically. We should be doing that when and where we can. So that answers the RFK question. I think he has some support. He certainly has some energy. He has some enthusiasm. He has some unique ideas and an ability to speak to them. I think ultimately he's going to be a benefit to us. I think he's going to hurt Biden. And I don't see his candidacy necessarily going anywhere. At the end of the day, there's plenty of things to attack him from on the right. So if anyone was starting to lean his way because of, let's say, his vaccine issues and his positions there, they could win that voter back on his positions as it comes to affirmative action or gun control or abortion or a whole litany of other issues where he generally resembles a standard Northeastern liberal than he does a disaffected working class Rust Belt voter or voter in the South or wherever else.
Do you think the No Labels Party is really that much of a threat? And I think they're trying to court somebody like, who was it, Manchin over in Virginia. And I also think they're trying to court RFK Jr. Now, the problem that everyone doesn't seem to realize about No Labels is that it's basically a Democrat third party. One of the founders is former Senator Joseph Lieberman from Connecticut. And then one of the other founders is a speechwriter for Joseph Biden. So the apple is not going to fall that far from the tree.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, look, I think it's primarily a Democrat, left-leaning, liberal organization, and I think the constituents that they would draw and the coalition they would build would reflect that. And I bring up my points I brought earlier about RFK. I think all of these potential challenges, all of this potential vote splitting that the Dems are trying to do in an act of desperation because they understand the ascendancy of President Trump, his movement, and the political dynamics in this country that are really pointing to his victory. They're getting desperate, and they're resorting to old tricks that may have, in election cycles past, had split the vote in such a way to ensure their victory. But again, I think they're going up against historical trends and rules of politics that when you have these third party challenges in whatever form, they typically hurt the incumbent. It's the incumbent who's defending their position. It's the incumbent who's defending the status quo. And I think this race in some ways obviously is unique. You have a former incumbent, so it could be described as an incumbent v. incumbent race. We haven't seen something like this since, you know, Grover Cleveland in the 1880s. So obviously President Trump's record is on the table as well, and it could be examined and reviewed, and it's not that far in the past for people's memories to recollect. But what we're seeing with all these different challengers is that they're simply just pulling away more disaffected Dems. I think there's far more Democrats who feel disaffected with Biden than there are Republicans who feel disaffected with Trump. I mean, if you look at the primary is a perfect example of it. I mean, he has shown he's set records, historical records, in his wins, despite in many cases being outspent by a large number, and despite facing unprecedented attacks from the courts, from the judicial system, from the media, and all the rest that we've known about for many, many years since he came down the escalator at Trump Tower. So the primaries, the polling, his favorabilities within the party, it points to a very stark contrast. Trump is the undisputed leader of the Republican Party. He cemented that most recently here on Super Tuesday with, you know, putting the Nikki campaign finally to bed. But even before then, it was very clear by the margins he was getting, both against, you know, conservative challengers or people supposedly trying to run to his right, like Ron DeSantis, and those running to the center or to his left, like Nikki Haley. He was able to vanquish all of them and come out with very commanding majorities. And I think that the Trump element of the Republican Party, this MAGA, America First, populist, however you want to describe it, I feel comfortable saying it's north of 90%. I think Nikki Haley's numbers of actual Republicans that support her world vision is 10% or less. And this includes adding, you know, Ron DeSantis's numbers and Vivek's numbers to Trump's numbers, because in many ways they share large elements of his vision. So you look on the other side with the Democrats, they don't have that sort of stability. They don't have that sort of cohesion right now like they once did under, say, an Obama. I think Biden is a historically weak figure, both on the national stage, but also within his own party. I think he's facing threats from the left. I think he's facing threats even from the center, from people who simply don't think he's, you know, suitable to run. So the pool of potential disaffected voters and constituents for someone like Biden is far greater. And because of that, they're far easier pickings for a No Labels, for a Manchin, for an RFK, for a Cornel West. And because of that, I encourage them to get on the ballot wherever they can. And I'm looking forward to their candidacies as a, you know, unabashed, you know, Trump supporter.
I had a listener of my show reach out to me not too long ago that claimed that they had some inside information, inside baseball, that Kamala Harris and Governor Pritzker were the ticket. It was not going to be Joe Biden. Joe Biden was going to be replaced. And this comes from a good spot where I would believe what I hear from this individual. What are the odds, do you think, that we're not even looking at a Trump-Biden race before November?
I think it's been decreasing with every day. I know that obviously there's various DNC bylaws and rules that would have made it easier some time ago to have made a switch, but I think they're in a lose-lose situation. I think any kind of switch like that, dramatic as it may be, is only going to hurt them. It's only going to show a lack of confidence, a lack of strength. It's going to, you know, bring on a sort of aura of chaos into their ranks. But beyond that, I mean, if you look at, you know, the fundamentals, and believe it or not, Joe Biden is the best candidate the Democrats have at the top of the ticket. I mean, he polls the best. He has the data to back up that his candidacy, despite how weak it may be, is actually their best. And anyone else that they try to put on that ticket has far more serious issues, is far more to his left, would alienate more voters, and would lead to a stronger and more overwhelming electoral landslide for the president. So the Dems are kind of stuck in this weird position where they understand the weaknesses and deficiencies of their candidate, President Joe Biden, but they also understand that he's the best they have. And that's for a variety of reasons. I mean, there's still a lot of low information voters who still think that, you know, Scranton Joe is a thing, that he's like that old moderate Democrat from yesteryear, the kind of working class Irish Catholic Democrat that no longer exists in many parts of the country in any significant level. And because of that, that still gives him a slight edge over many of these other individuals that
Gavin,
you reference, other reference.
In a lot of ways, though, I mean, I live in Delaware. Joe Biden still is that Democrat. His administration, the people pulling the strings, are the ones that are not. He's not, in my opinion, knowing the guy for the years that he served in Delaware, talking to him one-on-one throughout my young life when I was an 18-year-old. I'm now 45. I've had conversations with the president before he was president. He was that moderate Democrat. He was not off to the far left. His administration now, I think, has jumped straight into being completely on the far left. Right. And so I think that he appeals to those individuals that know that who he is. He's not one of them, but they're not paying attention to who's actually pulling the strings behind the curtain, because yeah, as we can all see, we got a frail president who's forgetting, you know, what flavor ice cream he probably likes at the end of the day.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. I think you're proving my point even more eloquently. I think that's really the benefit of him at the top of the ticket electorally. And I think, you know, getting rid of him and replacing him with the scenario you may have heard with a Kamala would be disastrous for them. I think she's the weakest potential candidate that they could put up there. And it's not much better for Gavin Newsom or many other names that have been circulated. So I think they have real problems. And I don't think this is as easy as trying to swap him out. I think they need him. But they're kind of stuck with him, and he may stop the bleeding based on the polls, but he isn't in a strong enough position to necessarily win based on the polls. Right. And the polls have been correct for this primary process, and I think the polls are going to be correct going into November. And I think whatever deficiencies exist in the polls and other quantitative data are deficiencies and issues and biases that work against President Trump. So when you look at these things and you see him up by the numbers he's up, these historical numbers on the RCP average, on the aggregate, and in a variety of different polls with different methodologies, with different sample sizes conducted over different periods of time, nationally, state level, whatever it may be, there's been a consistent trend, and it's been an overwhelming trend that the election is his to win right now, that he is in a dominant position going into November like he's never been before vis-a-vis 2020 or 2016. And frankly, compared to any previous Republican candidate that I can recall the last 20, 30 years, I don't think anyone had polling this good, this consistently, especially as a challenger against an incumbent. So I think a lot of things are working in President Trump's favor. And I think the Democrats have severe issues at the ballot box right now. And the administration that you were describing, you know, at the end of the day, government is really not just the head, it's not just the president, it's the next 1,000 people behind him who are running the administration of state. You reference them, those crazy leftists who are really running wild at the White House and the various agencies and departments. They're on a crash course to understanding politics in real time, because I think they're setting themselves up for a historic loss this November. And it doesn't matter what schemes or what machinations or what last minute tricks the DNC can come up with. I don't think that they can swap out. I don't think they can swap out Joe Biden at this point. And if they tried to swap out, say, Kamala Harris, who by all measures should be the next in line, then they would also run into an issue of, you know, pushing aside the first supposed African-American female presidential candidate. And that would also hurt them. So they can't get rid of her, and she's the worst. In terms of the polling, they can't get rid of him, and he's the best, but also the worst. So there's no easy answers for them. And I think that's why they're lashing out in the media, through the courts, through these kind of ridiculous and unconstitutional attacks on him that thankfully SCOTUS is slowly but, slowly shooting down. But we'll have to see what they do out of desperation.
What about Trump? So Trump's got to make a pick on a vice president here. Is there, out of his short list, he named Ron DeSantis, Byron Donalds, Tulsi Gabbard, which shocked me, Kristi Noem, Vivek Ramaswamy, and Senator Tim Scott. So he gave that list out several weeks ago. Is there anybody on that list that you think is the winning ticket, that's kind of like the slam dunk to get a few of the votes that are still left over to be people pushed over to the voting box?
I kind of doubt the veracity of that list, but I think as it comes to the VP pick, ultimately, President Trump has such a high name recognition, for better or for worse. He's such a dominant figure. He's an incumbent. He's a former incumbent. You know, the VP pick, especially in this cycle, is going to be such a minor thing as compared to previous cycles. He doesn't really need a VP to define him or his presidency. He doesn't necessarily even need a VP to really round out things. I think he's in a dominant position, politically speaking. I think at the end of the day, with these VP picks, there's certainly some cases to be made where he could expand his coalition, maybe soften some of the edges, so to speak, of his candidacy and appeal to maybe more old school Republican voting cohorts in the suburbs or upper middle class voters or college educated voters or women. You can make that argument, and some candidates certainly bring that to the table. I think other candidates are simply safe and would simply cement his position. But ultimately, I think the VP pick this time around is going to be, and compared to any other cycle, as I mentioned earlier, it's not going to be the biggest pick or decision or factor in this election. I think some of the top contenders that I legitimately think are probably in the running. I know a lot of names are thrown around, and there's a lot of court politics in terms of pushing these names to the media. I think, you know, Ben Carson is probably up there. I think Annalise Stefanik is probably up there. I think, you know, it's not going to be a candidate that's going to really shock anyone. I also don't even think that the person he picks is going to even necessarily be viewed as a successor in many ways. Obviously, a lot of VPs that are picked are viewed as a successor. I don't think we're even going to see that here. I think we're going to see a safe pick, a pick that doesn't really offend anyone, that doesn't really upset anyone. And at best, if we're going to talk electoral politics, it's a candidate that may help him win over that small slice of, you know, Republican voters, Republican-leaning voters that have drifted from the Republican Party since 2012 with Romney's candidacy.
I think you're absolutely correct as far as those vice president picks are concerned. I didn't buy that list for a second when that came out, and that's typical of Donald Trump and his strategy. He'll float the popular idea, and then he'll do his own work and pick the real candidate and the real person he wants. So I want to shift this a little bit. We have to worry about backstabbing grifters. You saw that story about Ed Cox, right? In New York, being part of that hack. People that don't know about it, he was part, or he sat on the board of the League of Conservation Voters. And he is the New York Republican, or New York State Republican, head honcho. And so this pack that he sat on also donated to people like Letitia James, Tom Suozzi, Kirsten Gillibrand, another degenerate. And this group also spent about $42 million on an anti-Trump pack as well in a campaign. So how do we get rid of these clowns, and what can we do against them?
Well, you're citing an article by my friend and colleague, Paul Ingracia, who wrote that for the Gateway Pundit. And, you know, I gave him some of the background on Ed, who I've been battling with in local New York politics for some time. He's not a fan of mine. I'm not a fan of his. I think he represents this old, crusty, curmudgeon establishment of old, of yesteryear, that is completely out of touch and out of sync with where the Republican Party is. He doesn't have his finger on the pulse of the Republican Party. And frankly speaking, he hasn't had any wins for the Republican Party. He served as chairman once before for a period of most of up to 10 years. And during his tenure of as chairman of the Republican Party of the state of New York in 10 years, he presided over the complete collapse of the party. And this was long predating Trump. You know, he lost the state Senate, which the Republicans actually held up until 2018, believe it or not, in New York, which provided some semblance of competitive government and a challenge to the monopolistic one-party rule of the Democrat machine in Albany in New York City. He lost that during his tenure. He lost more seats in the state assembly during that, during his tenure, getting into a super minority delegation that has basically no parliamentary powers whatsoever. It's a token opposition akin to something you'd see in a Soviet socialist republic. That was under his tenure. Our congressional delegation under his tenure shrank to its lowest. I think we had maybe one or two at most representatives. We didn't win a single statewide race in his 10-year tenure. We didn't win a single citywide race in his 10-year tenure. And then all the percentages we got in those races were some of the lowest percentages any Republican candidate, either in a citywide race or statewide race, had secured in many, many years. So he presided over a history of losing as Republican Party chairman. And of course, you know, in a private company, if you're such a loser for 10 years consistently, posting 10 years of negative profits, most people would vote, most shareholders would vote to kick that person out of their position running a company. That's how the private sector works. But of course, in politics, you could be a perennial loser. You can lose for 10 years, not bring anything to the table in terms of, you know, your ideology or vision, and not bring anything to the table in terms of wins, and you still get emboldened and empowered and remain in your comfy position as the party boss. So he came back to power recently, and now his new tenure is looking to be just as bad as his former term. He's already presided over two embarrassing special election losses, one for the state assembly in a district that Lee Zeldin won, a district that local Republicans have won, that has been won by President Trump. He lost that in Queens for state assembly. And then he also lost, obviously, most recently and more of national note, the New York 3 race with Mozzie Philip, you know, running a registered Democrat there, lost that race badly, even though $10 million was spent and a lot of resources were poured into it. So this is a guy that's presided over a party that's been losing consistently. And the article you're citing also shows that he has some nefarious and sketchy connections with, you know, large Democrat left-leaning PACs and networks of PACs that actively spend money to unseat Republicans, including President Trump. But why this guy is the chairman of the Republican Party of the state of New York, that's a very good question. But this is not just a New York story. This is a national story. There are a lot of chairmen, I would argue, both at the local, county, state level that are basically the Ed Coxes of their state. They do nothing to grow the party. They do nothing to bring in new voters. They do nothing to build coalitions to win elections. And listen, I can respect a party boss if they at least win. But I can respect a boss that maybe doesn't win, but at least is ideologically committed and has a vision. But if you present no vision or ideology and you can't even win elections, you're no good in politics. You have nothing to offer. And I understand people may be in very blue areas, and New York is certainly a blue area, but there is a sea of red here. And if we saw at the last gubernatorial race, before he took back his most recent term, by the way, he was not chairman when this happened, Lee Zeldin got 47%. So there are certainly trends in New York and New York City that are working in Republicans' favor. Some of the biggest shifts to the right for President Trump happened in the five boroughs and many working class Hispanic neighborhoods and communities in in the city, many Asian American communities in the city. So there's a lot of and working class white communities in the city. There's a lot of trend lines in New York that could work in our favor, where we could grow our presence politically on the city council, in the state legislature. And with those seats come power, and we could actually turn back and fight back against this one party managed decline of the Empire State. But someone like Ed Cox, you know, he's an entrenched political establishment creature. And the problem with our system in this country is that the political office holders, the party office holders, are not elected by Republican voters, believe it or not. No one elects him from the Republican primary. He doesn't go on a primary ballot and have to actually make his case to the voters. He's elected by a small body of state committeemen, as they're known in New York. It has different names depending on the state you're at, who are consequently elected by other party bosses and other county committees. So it's so many degrees of separation between party leadership. And this is the same thing at the RNC at the national level. There's so many degrees of separation between party leadership at the state, local, and national level from their actual Republican voters. So we always talk about this dichotomy, oh, Republican voters support Trump. Republican voters support X, Y, and Z in terms of their policy positions. And then you go over to the party leader, and they laugh at that. They don't support any of that. All they support is what the donors want or their aligned grifting consultants support, because the party has become a slush fund. It's become a slush fund in New York. It's become a slush fund in other states, where they raise money, they grift money from the grassroots and even from these kind of frankly rich but dumb donors. And it goes into their pockets, into their friends, who are in many cases consultants, and they enrich themselves. And the only times they actually act as a representative of anyone, it's for donor interest. So they'll be most angry and most passionate about things that are passionate to a donor. But a donor and the donor class, particularly the donor class of the Republican Party, is as out of touch as the political leadership of the Republican Party. They're so far apart from the average Republican voter, many of whom are working class, middle class Americans who are looking to see their country turn around, to see the state turn around, to see their cities and communities turn around and get back on the right track. But most leadership is just content to lose. They're content to be token opposition. And in the case of Ed Cox, in many cases, they're in bed with the enemy. They're Manchurian chairman. They're Manchurian party leaders, because they're totally in bed with the left and the Dems. And they enrich themselves there. And I think, you know, you can make a strong conspiratorial argument that many times they purposely lose races and sabotage races because they have some financial connections or other connections to the Democrats. So it's a scandal, I think, here in New York. I think he's widely unpopular. He's viewed as very weak. But because of the bylaws, because of the Byzantine system and the laws that basically enshrine this party establishment into being, it's very hard to replace him. You would have to really start taking over all the Republican parties in various counties, taking over their county committees, and then taking over their state committee people positions. And it's a long and expensive and tedious process, and they know it, he knows it. So really the only way we can fight them is make a mockery of them in the media, on social media, in alternative media, in podcasts like this, and shame them basically until they have to resign or are forced out by external means. But the actual party hierarchy, it's designed by its very nature to protect corrupt and incompetent party bosses like Ed Cox.
Well, you guys can take the high road. I'll take the low road. Let me come to the last name. so the other thing is, I had the displeasure of living in New York and Arizona during Trump's presidency.
Oh boy.
I run for office, so I can validate the fact that these decisions are made long before the election. They're made behind closed doors, and these elections are determined way early in the year before November. When I was in Arizona, I was bumming around with some of Ducey's people, which by default is also going to be McCain's people, and they could not stand Trump. They hated Trump. They said what they had to get elected, but ultimately they did not follow any of Trump's policies. And in New York, after Trump's presidency, the Republicans out here, at least on Long Island where I am, they're basically Democrats running on a Republican ticket. They don't like Trump. They'll do everything they can to not push any of his policies.
No, you're bringing it up. I mean, there's a certain, like, I don't even know how to describe it, like almost a classism that comes with it. They stick their nose up at Trump supporters, and they just don't share that ideology, those principles, that vision of the United States and the world at large. They are just maybe creatures of another era. They're living in another time. They're out of touch. They're in a bubble. I mean, a lot of them are very much in a bubble. And even the ones that are in office or manage to win elections, they win elections because they have an R next to their name. And then many people vote for them because they have an R next to their name. And then they go to Congress or whatever body they happen to be serving in. And they really just do a massive disservice to their constituents. They don't represent them and they don't care. And this is why, you know, my club, my organization, we take a very active role in primary processes, and we endorse candidates in primaries, and we're viewed as, you know, going against the grain, being rebels, insurrectionists, you know, not supporting the party, not supporting the party bosses. But in our view, it says, you know, we're Republican auxiliary organization. So where we have our most influence is really in a Republican primary. And that's where we're going to exert our most influence, because that makes the most sense as a political organization. So as a political organization, we are to the right, we're conservative, we're populist, however you want to describe us. And we're going to ensure that the candidates that we nominate in winnable races, and even in races that are unwinnable for a variety of reasons, we want that candidate to be committed to the principles and vision of the Republican Party. And I think that makes us better team players to the Republican Party than these guys that use the Republican Party as a vehicle to enrich themselves and to snub their own voters. And it's just a time and again, we have these debates, we have these fights, and this latest debacle with Ed Cox is the same thing. But hopefully things are changing. I think we're seeing a lot of resentment brewing. I think we're seeing a lot of people getting more active in the Republican Party, and I think they're getting more upset with the failings of the Republican Party, and they're calling to account the leadership. Because they see that simply getting them elected is not enough, that you have to hold their feet to the fire. You have to stay on top of them. You have to continue to pressure them. And in doing so, you may actually get what you voted them to do to begin with. But unless you stay on top of them, many times, you know, these guys, they will sneer and jeer at you behind closed doors. They'll laugh at their voters behind closed doors. They'll make fun of their voters behind closed doors. They're pretty contemptible in a lot of ways, but it's a problem from Arizona to New York, as you just said.
Well, I think the Republican Party as a general whole has a major problem. And as you're talking this through, I can't help but think about the parallel of the Libertarian Party throughout this country and the Mises Caucus, and how they overtook the Libertarian Party from the death grip, so to speak, of the traditional libertarians. And they renewed their vision over the last 4 years within that party. Right now, I believe Republicans are in that same exact arena. There's the old guard Republicans, the people that have gotten themselves involved in the Uniparty. There's the true conservative Republicans that are trying to find their cause and trying to find their place in the party. And then we have to also acknowledge there's some absolute bat-crap crazy Republicans as well that likely have some crazy ideas about where they would like things to go. I'm concerned that we're in a vacuum of good leadership. The only face that the Republican Party has that people are getting energized behind at the present moment, as far as a large face, is Donald Trump. My curious question is, you know, is Vivek Ramaswamy up next? You know, is there anybody that is going to carry the torch on? Because you said, I don't expect the vice president to be somebody that Donald Trump relies on, and I don't think that they're a viable candidate for a standalone president afterwards. So where is conservatism after 4 years of a Donald Trump presidency in 2025 coming in January? I'm very concerned about that.
I completely agree with you. I share your concerns. I think we definitely have issues going forward with the next generation of Republican leadership. I would argue we're in some ways still better than the Democrats do in terms of who's going to carry the torch for them going forward. But we certainly still have issues in terms of a leader that's going to rally people, that they're going to feel committed to, that they're going to go into battle with, politically speaking, of course. And I think that's an issue that, you know, it's recurring in politics. You have a dominant political force in Donald Trump, and replacing that and being the second act to that is never an easy act to follow. He's not an easy act to follow. So it's going to be difficult to maintain that. I think, you know, over the next, if he were to win through his second term, I think, you know, more answers to that will develop over time, and leaders will begin to emerge, and the field will begin to develop more clearly. But it's certainly an issue. And I think, generally speaking, I agree with you. There is a lack of leadership in the Republican Party overall. I'm not talking about at the top of the ticket, but I'm talking institutionally at the local, state, and even national levels. And I also share your concerns that in many cases, you know, you could have someone, you know, we talk about one end of the spectrum. We talk about these kind of, you know, these corrupt establishment goons, but then the other end of the spectrum, you have kind of the wacky, kind of crazy, you know, all, you know, out of left field kind of individuals that also, you know, maybe they're a little bit more sympathetic and maybe they maybe make you laugh, but they're also not good for politics. And they're not good to run as a candidate, and they also hurt us, and we lose seats that could be won because of it. So there's obviously a balance. There's a balance where you can find, you know, professional candidates that are articulate and can speak to the issues and can speak to voters, but are also still principled. You know, it shouldn't be between, you know, someone who thinks the earth is flat and someone who wants to rob you and pay his consultant friends. I think that's a pretty crappy dichotomy, but in many cases, that dichotomy is encouraged. And I think that's also a machination of the establishment. They say, oh, you don't want to elect our clean cut establishment guy who is going to sell you short to the Democrats and to donor interests. Okay, fine. You can have your candidate. And it's the person that's wearing a boot on their head or something, or you know, has no shoes. I don't know.
The rent's too damn high.
The rent's too damn high, you know, that kind of a vermin supreme vermin kind supreme, of character. Yeah. So it's like, you know, they play these games often. They say, okay, you don't want us. This is who you're getting. When in many cases, you know, there is a conservative, a sensible conservative alternative that could be elevated, but the establishment tries everything they can to crush those types of candidates and those types of people. And they do everything they can to discourage those types of people from rising through the party apparatus. They want people that they can control, that are kind of empty suits, empty, you know, bird brains, if you will, that they can control and manipulate as they work their way up the party apparatus. They don't want people that can think on their own, that are have any convictions, that have any leadership ability. So they create this situation where it's either you take their empty suit or you take the crazy. And I think that's a problem we face in a lot of Republican parties across the country. And it's unfortunate for sure. But look, I think the next mantle of Republican leadership, I think it's going to be a slugfest in 2028 for the primary. And I think through that contest, a leader should emerge. I hope a good one does. I think there are certainly some leaders across the country. You know, I'm a big fan of Congressman Matt Gaetz. I think he's a stalwart in the House. I'm a big fan of his. And I think there's other leaders that are emerging in Congress and the Senate. I think, you know, I'm a big fan of J.D. Vance in the Senate. So I think there's a lot of different Republicans of different ideological backgrounds. They're not all consistent. Some are more libertarian, some are more populist. But I certainly think we're developing a much better bench of potential future leaders than the Democrats are. And I think everyone they have on their bench are kind of you know, varying degrees of corrupt, incompetent, and far too extreme.
Gavin, I want you to talk to liberal voters for a moment here on the show. And this is the liberal voter that I want you to address. To the liberal voters who say, how can someone re-elect Donald Trump, a guy who is a danger to the democracy? The guy has the playbook from Hitler. He's going to be the next dictator. He'll never leave office. It's 4 more years, and then he's going to find a way to stay because the playbook's already there. How do you talk to a liberal who believes that the sky is falling if Donald Trump gets reelected?
Give me all the easy questions. No, look, it's difficult. I mean, you know, I do think there's still a lot of, you know, common sense liberals out there who maybe we disagree. Maybe we have disagreements in terms of our worldview. Maybe we share, you know, a desire to fix problems that we both recognize. We just have different paths to get there. You know, maybe those voters you could speak to or I could speak to, I think they're starting to dwindle in number. I think the country is becoming as a whole very, politicized and divided, and we're moving into separate camps, very tribal. In many ways, many parts of the country are post-political, that they'll nominate someone, you know, regardless of the political dynamics, just because they share the party of their choice, and there's nothing you could do to convince them. It's past, it's post-persuasion politics, and that's what the Democrats want by and large. But I'm going off on a tangent. As to the liberal voter, I mean, listen, you know, you can make claims that democracy is threatened, but I would encourage them to look at the actions that the so-called Democratic Party is taking to unseat their opposition, the prosecutions, the maneuvers to take him off the ballot, a maneuver that was recently struck down by the Supreme Court in a unanimous decision, including many left-wing liberal justices. I think, you know, you may not like President Trump, you may not agree with all of his positions, but the notion that he is undemocratic in any sense is laughable. He came up through the Democrat process. He came up through, you know, our constitutional process, winning at the Electoral College. He served out his 4-year terms, and there were many, many successes that even a liberal can recognize. You know, quantitative, objective successes on the economy, with foreign policy. You can brush them off, you can write them off because you don't like him. But some of the things that he was able to accomplish in his 4-year terms, had they been accomplished by a Joe Biden, a Hillary Clinton, or an Obama, you would be praising. So my only appeal to the liberal voter is to try your best to be objective, try your best to see through the weeds here and see through the narratives and the manipulation, and see him. Maybe you won't like him, maybe you won't vote for him, but the kind of hysterical, over-the-top rhetoric that he's a dictator, that he's a fascist, that he's all these sorts of things, it only makes having a political discourse, having constructive conversations very difficult. That was very hard for me to do because I don't often try to appeal to liberals because that's not my shtick, but I tried my best. So
I can promise you that probably won't work. That argument that you made, it doesn't.
I agree. It won't work. I was struggling through it as I bought it, but that's the best I could do, guys.
You had to sell it.
Well, Michaels knows that whenever we talk to people on the right, we seem to have people that we can never go and include them enough. And so I just wanted to make sure we're including all Michaels, you know, make sure for that, you know, give an olive branch out. I do like to do that actually on the show. Like, I never like to just go, hey, this is a win no matter what. And I've made the case on the show over the last several months that, in all honesty, I wish that this election didn't come down to Donald Trump and Joe Biden. I wish that this country had gotten to a point at this point in time where we have a younger generation ready to serve and step up as president of the United States. And unfortunately, we're just not there as far as the stable of young people growing and America being ready. Turning Point USA, I know you're an ambassador to Turning Point. And they're doing a good work in trying to get into high schools, college campuses. Tell me a little bit about the work that's going on leading up to 2024 as an ambassador and what TP is working on.
Listen, I mean, I do a lot of work, in terms of youth and politics, obviously with the club and also through Turning Point. And I think, you know, it's vital to continue to, you know, engage in activism and grassroots, you know, organization with younger voters. I think the left, they have their levers of power. They can, you know, brainwash tons of people coming up through the public school system and the higher education system and obviously through the media. So we have a very uphill battle in order to either maintain people that come from conservative families or to win over people that are either apolitical or come from more liberal-leaning households. And I think Turning Point does a good job of it. I think they're part of the equation. I think they're part of the overall effort. I think, you know, young Republican clubs like myself, which are more geared towards young professionals in their mid-20s to mid-30s, also are a big role in that. Outside of the campuses, outside of the high schools. But listen, I think, you know, we need to be organizing. I think, you know, Republicans, if there's anything we can learn from the left, is their ability to build infrastructure politically, their ability to organize politically. You know, people made fun of Barack Obama for being a community organizer, but, you know, I look to what they've structured, how they've structured their entire political apparatus, and it's commendable. They have a very real machine, throughout the entire, you know, all elements of society, and that's how they continue to win elections. That's how they dominate areas with almost dictatorial powers in some of these one-party areas. And, you know, we don't have to emulate every aspect of that, but we should at least study it and realize that we need to organize parallel structures because we're on the outside. We're not the orthodoxy. We are not the establishment. We're the counterculture in many ways. We're the political renegades. We don't really control the levers of power. Even when we do hold office, we're still on the back foot. It's really the left-wing dogma that rules, that reigns supreme in this country. And because of that, we need to, you know, build parallel structures like they did in behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War. So we need to have, you know, our own networking, our own clubs, our own, you know, areas where people can socialize, where people can find jobs, where people can work, where people can, you know, connect with one another. And I think Turning Point is part of that. I think clubs are part of that. I think alternative media is part of that. And I think, you know, all these different things we need to build. You know, we can't just be against things. We can't just complain about things being biased against us. We need to build alternatives. We need to build alternatives in terms of organizations especially, and we need to keep people organized because obviously their voters march in lockstep. Many of them are in public sector unions. Many of them are motivated by, you know, other things like welfare and, you know, this kind of religious ideology that they've taken on to replace, you know, God in many senses. Our voters, you know, they're living day to day. They're working 9 to 5. They're just trying to manage their own life, their own families. You know, they may lean our way. They may lean conservative, lean Republican, but, you know, they don't have the time or energy devoted to the same way an average Democrat Party foot soldier does. So to that end, we need to organize, and we need to build organizations that can turn out voters, that can keep voters engaged, that can, you know, respond to the left and their narratives. And we don't do a good job of doing that, unfortunately. And because of that, we lose winnable seats and we lose ground to the left with every passing year. So I think organizations like Turning Point are helping there, but I encourage others to do the same locally and build up organizations like the New York Young Republican Club and like others to keep people engaged, keep people active, and, you know, continue to have a political existence outside of the 4-year electoral cycle. You know, Republicans think very short term. They think just in terms of the next election cycle, and then there's no organization. Democrats, they think generationally. They're thinking, how can I do a Fabian style takeover of your institution over a generation, over 20, 30 years? You know, I'm not saying we have to go to those lengths, but I'm saying we should at least, you know, narrow the gap between these two opposing worldviews. And I'm saying, you know, we should have political organizations that still do things, that are still active, you know, in off cycles when there isn't an election. You know, Republicans put a lot of money into PACs. They put a lot of money into candidates. Democrats, they build up nonprofits. They build up these entire networks of nonprofits, of think tanks and other things that really keep their army alive, their political army alive. And we have to do the same on our side if we want to compete in the years to come.
If you could give Trump one piece of campaign advice for this election cycle, what would it be?
Oh, good question. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I think him and his campaign have done a really good job through this primary and even into the general. And I think, you know, it's a really lean machine that's been doing very well. I mean, now pivoting to the general, I think, you know, I think stay true to the course. I think, you know, stay committed. And I believe he will. So maybe this advice is not really necessary, but I think, you know, don't moderate. Don't change your position going into the general. Campaign exactly as you have been on the positions you have been. You know, I don't think there's a huge percentage of persuadable voters out there, but if they are winnable, if they are persuadable, it's not going to be because you moderated extensively or you shifted to the left in any means. Continue to be tactical, but continue to focus on your core issues, which are the borders, the mass migration at the border, immigration, illegal immigration, globalization and the foreign policy debacles, and focus on those core issues and continue to hold true. Again, like with the liberal question, it's hard for me to do because I really think he's doing a good job anyway. So hopefully that was okay.
So Gavin, in 2020, you were awarded the Republican Youth of the Year Award in Queens Village Republican Club. By 2021, you were named the rising star of the New York State Young Republicans Club. In 2022, you spoke at CPAC over in the European conservative side of it. You also brought a lawsuit against the state of New York about the state assembly lines. You've been a mover and shaker. I don't know exactly how old you are. I'm not even sure I need to ask you that question, but I will ask you this. Will we have an opportunity to vote for Gavin Wax in the future?
Oh man. Listen, I live in Manhattan. You know, I don't really live in an area with a lot of political, you know, ability to move up the ranks, so to speak. It's not really politically fertile ground for someone who has my views. You know, I'm playing everything by day. I'm not the kind of person that woke up one morning and said, you know, I want to be president, or, you know, these kind of political creatures you meet that come out of Petri dishes and say, you know, I'm going to be president. I'm going to run for this. I'm going to run for that. I'm doing things, you know, that I believe in. I'm doing things that I enjoy. You know, I'm taking everything day by day. If an opportunity someday arises to run for some elected office, whether locally or at the state level or otherwise, I'll definitely consider it. I'm not going to run just for the sake of running. I don't want to run to lose. I don't think that's effective. I think, you know, I can, you know, do a lot better work with what I've been doing in terms of activism and writing and commentating and all the rest. But listen, I'm not going to rule it out. If again, if something comes up, I'm definitely jump at it, but, it's not necessarily in the cards. I, you know, I've worked in the private sector. That's my background. I've been working in media and advertising and now doing more consultant and more finance based work. And I think we need that. I think, you know, we have a lot of people that, you know, run for office that they've only ever been political creatures. They've never held a job in the private sector. They've never had a regular job. They've never done anything. They've just worked in government jobs or political jobs. And then you wonder why they're really lackluster. You wonder why they're really milquetoast. You wonder why they're not really inspiring, because they have no life experiences to relate to the average voter. The average voter is not a political creature. They're not moving up through the party hierarchy. They're not moving up through the political hierarchy. They just want to see their lives improved, and they want people that can speak to them and they can relate to. And I think the way that we recruit candidates and the way we, you know, build up the party is we find these people in the good old boy network who have been, you know, kissing enough ass for so long that they eventually throw them a title or a position. And I think those guys always cause us to lose. And I think, you know, in many ways, President Trump was extremely unique as a presidential candidate, especially because he wasn't a general and he wasn't a former politician. He was just a businessman. And, you know, I think maybe that line has maybe been overdone as it describes President Trump, but I still think there's a lot of truth to it, that people are looking for something different. They're looking for authenticity. And I think in this day and age, especially with social media, I think people are kind of, you know, tired of the consultant driven candidates who repeat slogans, who repeat, you know, the talking points, who don't really think outside the box, who can't really, you know, speak with passion or with heart on anything. And I think those are the exact types of candidates that our system on both sides of the aisle really elevate. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm just going to live my life, do my thing. If an opportunity arises, I'd obviously consider it. But as of now, I don't really see any Republican renaissance happening in Manhattan anytime soon, unfortunately.
Well, Gavin, I think that your future is bright. I will look back on this interview, I believe, in the future, and we'll be interviewing you again, but in a different context. I really do believe that. There's something I can tell talking to you. You're knowledgeable and you're knowing how to move up the ranks by helping to elevate others. And that is something that is sorely needed. You know, you want to educate others about the Constitution, you want to educate others about the conservative values and finding ways. And if you can teach a person the fish, they can eat forever, and you're teaching plenty of people the fish. For my listeners, you can check out Gavin Wax at Gavin Wax on socials. Go to X, type in at Gavin Wax. You can also check out his website, gavinwax.com, where he puts up the articles that he's on, as well as find out his book that I talked about earlier tonight. Make sure that you go and check that out. That just came out back in January, The Emerging Populist Majority, which he is a co-writer on. I don't want to stiff your co-writer in giving all the credit there, but a great contributor in that. And Gavin, we got to get ready for a State of the Union now coming up in about 15 minutes at the end of this taping. So I appreciate all the time that you gave Chris Michaels and myself and the Bold American audience here on the America Out Loud Network, as well as all of the hundreds of people that are tuned in live tonight that are watching. Wish you guys all the best. Hope that we honored your time well. Gavin, thanks for coming on to the show.
Thank you guys for having me. Great show. Looking forward to joining you again.
Wonderful. All right, Bold Americans, that is it. That is all. Thanks for spending your time with Chris Michaels and myself here on America Emboldened. We'll be back next week to do all of this again. Plus, you know, Michaels, what do you say? Do you want to stay and launch a new StreamYard? And we will maybe do the State of the Union live. Do you got the energy for that?
What do you think? I mean, we could.
We could. I mean,
supposedly running 20 minutes late, so we have plenty of time.
Okay, I can go. You know, get a cup of coffee or whatever it is that I am into, and then go from there. That sounds good. All right, make sure you guys give Gavin a follow if you're not already following. You can follow Chris Michaels at Last Call Caravan. Obviously, you're on my page at Real Greg Bolden. If you're not following already and you like these type of interviews, always bring you great content, both Chris Michaels and myself. So make sure you follow so you don't miss those in the future. We'll be back around 9:20, everybody, if you want to tune back in. But for the show on America Out Loud, that's it. That's all. You've been listening to America Emboldened with Greg Bolden and Chris Michaels, our special guest, Gavin Wax, here on the America Out Loud News Network. Be bold, America.